Welcome to the Vocation and the Common Good podcast. I'm your host, Philip Lourish, and today my guest is Tish Harrison Warren. Tish is the co-associate rector at the Church of the Ascension in Pittsburgh, and as an extension of her pastoral ministry, Tish is a writer whose work has been published in Christianity Today, The Well, and elsewhere online. In her recent book, The Liturgy of the Ordinary, Tish points to the importance of everyday practices for the Christian life. I really enjoyed our wide-ranging conversation and hope you do as well.
My God, where will I go? Glory. Where I reap and where I sow? Glory. And my hands, they grip the thorns. Glory. In the still and in the storm.
I want to ask you about writing and your self-understanding as a writer. I was talking with a friend who is a writer. We were having a very heady discussion about essentially theological anthropology. And he said to me, my theological anthropology is essentially that we all have a hustle. The writer's hustle is paying attention. And it struck me that you're really good at that.
I'm always looking for metaphor.
Where does that come from?
I can't really explain it. I mean, I never set out to be a writer. I didn't know I was going to be a writer. I didn't think I'm going to write a book someday and write a lot for my life. So that happened accidentally. But I actually think the metaphor thing was from when I was a little kid. For whatever reason, I feel like I need metaphor, like people need food and water. I need concrete things to explain invisible things to me. And I just feel like I've been like that since I was a little kid, just like craving understanding. And for me, understanding always comes through finding the right metaphor. It's like almost a euphoric experience when I land on something where I'm like, aha, this is what I'm trying to say. This is what I'm feeling.
So you have to try on metaphors that don't work first?
Yes.
How does that work?
Well, probably in conversation, I use metaphors a lot. So because of that, all the time, I'll write something or I'll say something and I'll kind of get halfway through it and be like, yeah, this is sort of falling apart. This isn't really working. This doesn't explain well. That's what's so wonderful about writing is that you get lots of drafts. So the first draft of my book was terrible. It was saccharine and it was awful. I remember using this whole metaphor. It was in my chapter on food and I talked about soup and about like selling your soul. It was horrible. It was terrible.
Soup and selling your soul?
Well, selling your birthright, right? For like a poor, it's like in scripture. And I mean, as I was writing it, it was like, this is brilliant. And then as I kept writing, I was like, this is really stupid. But I left it in there. And then I came back, you know, a month later and was like, yeah, this is really stupid and took it out, which is good. But so that's what's so great about writing. I can put any thought that floats in my head at the moment on the page, and I don't have to worry about whether it's good or not, and I can come back and fix it later. You get lots of tries.
My sense is that writers like to think of themselves as really courageous people, that they have the capacity to tell the truth, and they're stepping into a scenario in which the world is looking at something incorrectly, and they're going to name it correctly, and that there's a sort of truth-teller component to a writer's self-conception. It sounds to me like you're saying, no, you just try stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, it doesn't feel super brave. Maybe that's because I'm not doing like edgy enough stuff. It feels more like trying to make sense of the life I'm living. And that feels necessary more than brave. I mean, we're all trying to do that in different ways. I am privileged that I have the kind of life that I can write to do that. I mean, that comes from the fact that I'm educated, the fact that my husband's really supportive of this, the fact that God opened this door, which was a total surprise to me for this to happen. So this is one of the ways that I sort of make sense of what I'm experiencing. And it's a gift that I get to do that. So
how did God open this door?
I always loved to write. I have stuff from when I was like little. I wrote a poem to my sister when I was 7 years old and she was leaving for college. I used a thesaurus for the first time in my life and got the word mire for mud. And I rhymed it with fire. And I just thought I was so sophisticated and And it, my sweet sister, who was 8 years older than me, framed it and put it in her college dorm room. So that was like amazing for me. So I loved writing, but I always really, what I wanted to do growing up was be in ministry. I wanted to be a pastor, which I am now. But so when I was in campus ministry, my campus group got kicked off campus and we realized blogs were happening then. I mean, they weren't new. They were kind of in their heyday. It was like when everyone was blogging. And I had tried a few blogs and never stuck with it really. But we realized that, you know, Fox News and USA Today were putting out stories on this. And we felt like we need to tell our story and we need some outlet to even just update people who care about us and care about what's happening on campus. But we didn't want to do it as individuals. We wanted to do it as like a staff team. And so I ended up writing and editing most of that. So I spent like a year basically with campus ministry. I was doing a ton of writing. And that's never what you end up doing in campus ministry, but it just so happened that there was this national news story on our campus. And so we felt like we need to be telling this to our people and really making this case in a thoughtful way. I actually don't remember the year. I think it was 2011. And I was working in campus ministry and I got this letter from the campus chaplain that said that we had to drop any requirement of belief for anyone in our organization or we would lose our on-campus status as a registered campus organization. So that meant we couldn't ask Bible study leaders to affirm the truth of Scripture or belief in the Trinity or anything. There could be no religious requirement for anyone at any level of our organization. So with a student president, we had a president of our organization. We couldn't ask to be of any particular religious persuasion, even though it was an evangelical group. It was within our varsity. So this could be a very long story, but it was a year of a lot of upheaval and a lot of discussion and a lot of back and forth and anger on campus and also confusion because the policy wasn't rolled out. Even within the administration, different administrators had very different opinions on the policy, on the goodness of the policy, but also on like literally what the policy was. Like they couldn't decide what this was actually going to enact. And so it was a tumultuous year. And then at the end of it, 14 campus religious organizations lost their registered student status. So we were effectively kicked off campus. The administration doesn't like us to say that we were kicked off campus because it's not like those students aren't allowed to go to class or something, but the organization doesn't exist as a recognized organization anymore. 1,400 students were affected, which is about a tenth of the campus, I think. So that happened. And then simultaneously, honestly, like in prayer, I felt strongly called to write. And I never used those words. Like I wouldn't say I felt strongly called to get married or strongly called to have, like I never used those words, but it was like this suffocating sense that I'm supposed to be writing more. And then my friend, Marsha, she was an editor of a blog called The Well, which was for women in the academy and professions. And she had asked me to write something on rest. And so I had. And she really liked it and just said, you're a great writer. I want you to write for us more. And really kind of like bugged me about it, like asked me to write. And it was like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And then I hadn't 3 months later and asked me to write again. And so she like kept coming back and asking me. And so I did. I wrote for her and I wrote a couple blog posts. And then one of them, it was like my first or second one, went crazy, crazy viral. Like thousands of people read it. And Andy Crouch picked it up. He said, you're a great writer. And he had actually read some of my stuff from the years before when I was doing campus ministry and writing. So he said, if you ever want to pitch to Christianity Today, we would love for you to do that. And then I did. And then I've started writing for them a lot, and then it just sort of...
Did it start where you were just kind of chronicling what was going on at Vandy at the time?
Chronicling, but also making a case. We were talking about pluralism and why that is the best way forward for the university, like robust, principled pluralism. So a lot of our pieces were sort of making that case in various ways. So it started there, but honestly, it really started with writing for The Well. That was the first time I started to understand myself as maybe someone who could write and who could write for more than like a hobby.
So what strikes me about your start writing then is that you were writing as a representative of a community, like a champion of a community's story. And
yeah, I've never thought about that, but that's right.
Does it feel that way now?
Yeah, a lot of times it does. I'm an Anglican priest and I write a lot out of that. And I'm a woman that grew up in evangelicalism. So I feel like I'm part of that community. Now I have friends that are Christian women writers. That's kind of a world. But yeah, it feels like I have tried to write out of who I am, and who I am is inevitably and deeply shaped by community. So I've never tried to write so that I could appeal to all people, or so that, like, what I'm saying is I think that in evangelical writing, there can be a tendency to try to not show your tradition, because once you do, it will limit your audience because not everyone's going to like or resonate with your tradition. But I'm really big on showing your tradition, like putting your cards on the table about where you're coming from. If that limits my audience, so be it. And if not, great. But I think we have the best conversations when we show our tradition first, kind of, and we can talk out of that from different perspectives. My experience of writing is very communal. So I'm a big believer in editors. For a writer to say that used to be like, duh.
Pour one out for the editors.
Yeah. But like, you know, you used to not have writers without having editors,
yeah, right?
That was a given. But now in the world of blogs and social media, that has become less and less. But I don't think I've ever published anything without an editor. I swear by editors. And part of that is I think writing's really communal. So I know that, like, often it's thought of as sort of like the singular person in a room thinking thoughts, but that is part of it. And I really love that part. As an introvert that verbally processes, it suits me well to sit in a room writing out thoughts. But then it always, for me, goes to several people that I'm like, having conversations about these pieces with. And that's part of the process. And that's a really joyful part of the process. Most of the editors I work with, I love. Like, they're friends now.
Where can my soul?
What does it mean to lead with your identity as an Anglican priest? How does that liberate or constrain what you're capable of doing in public?
It constrains, because I walk in the room with a certain set of ideas about what Christianity means and what it doesn't mean that will inevitably be different than other people. So, I mean, that can look a lot of different ways. Like, some of it is my theology is not going to be welcomed in every place. And that can be on the right or on the left. I won't be welcomed in every place. But it's also just things like, I have found that often in evangelical writing and in evangelical world, I feel really, really Catholic. Like, I feel like, oh, I don't even understand the conversation happening here because I have a really high view of the church. And so, like, I don't even entirely understand what you're talking about. Like, you're talking about a world that is foreign to me. And so because of that, I think there's some conversations I just sort of don't participate in as much, or can't participate in as much. So that was how it constrains. How it liberates us, I mean, I think Christianity itself is the narrative that has shaped my world. And I think that it's the most glorious, imaginative, vivid, colorful narrative that exists. And so I feel like it made things technicolor for me. But also, Anglicanism specifically is incredibly metaphor-driven, right? It's incredibly symbol-driven. And so I can't see water without thinking about baptism. I can't take a meal without thinking about the Eucharist, you know? And this is just part of the sort of ordinary warp and woof of my life is these symbols. I mean, to the extent that, like, for the last 3 weeks, my four-year-old, when she knelt down for communion, during communion, literally when the cup was like up to her mouth, she turns to me and goes, "Is this wine or is this blood?" And I'm like, "This is, we have to talk about that later."
could be both, right?
Right, exactly. And there's something magical. I just think my universe is very magical. If there's anything that I hope to do with writing, it's that I just want to like re-enchant the world for people, re-enchant people's ordinary day. That was very much what I wanted with this book, is that something as simple as getting stuck in traffic could be like spiritual, but also enchanted in the sense of like, you just never know when God's going to show up and like magical things will happen. G.K. Chesterton said, he believes in God because he believes in fairies, right? I mean, I don't take that exactly literally, but I think what he's saying is that like the universe just isn't a closed place for him. It's wild and it's unpredictable. Beautiful, magical things could happen at any moment. It's not a closed sort of naturalistic system. I feel like Anglicanism does that to me. Like it just opens me up to there being mystery all the time.
I'm wondering for you, Tish, what the major barriers to enchantment are on a daily basis. So I'm thinking about, I love grocery shopping, oddly enough.
I do too. No, I really do.
Because I like finding the perfect avocado, you know?
I love grocery shopping.
But I think I also love a certain type of serendipity of like, oh, I'll make this instead of that. But increasingly, I have optimized my life such that serendipity is almost completely out of the question.
Yeah.
So I know, just to keep things sane, that I can order something on Amazon Prime and it'll come at this point. And if we wanted to, we could order 5 nights of meals a week to come through whatever service that delivers them in a box. And you just put the ingredients together and voila, you look like a really good cook, you know? I totally want enchantment. I also want ease, comfort, and a certain degree of frictionless existence. How do you square that circle? I mean, what do you do in that scenario?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Because the fact is, like, I don't think very much in our culture at all is like pointing to enchantment, right? It's pointing to like utilitarianism. I mean, it's pointing to exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, when you asked me what is like the obstacle to that, even before you said that, the first place my brain went is like busyness. Busyness is the biggest obstacle I have to that. And something like utility, just wanting things to be simple, right? Like a fairy story wouldn't be a fairy story if it was like everything happened easily and there was no obstacle in the story, right? And so I can tell you, this is getting personal, but part of the reason I've been thinking so much about this is that, so the last 6 months have been really, really hard for my husband and I and my whole family. We moved from my hometown across the country for a new job. And then a week later, my dad passed away, sort of suddenly back where we were from. And then we've had 2 miscarriages since then. One was a late miscarriage in second trimester. It was a hard, long pregnancy and I was on bed rest. So in a way that I haven't experienced before, it's just been a season of loss and grief, kind of one major loss after another, with some smaller losses kind of thrown in there that I won't even mention, but it's just been sort of a season of loss. And what I'm finding is that my response to that is like craving beauty and craving silence, like voraciously. I can't read most theological books now. Like I just really can't read them. They make me angry, not because they're wrong, but because they're just not beautiful. Like they're not written beautifully. And so the things that I'm like going to for reading and with my time are like beauty and silence. And I'm thinking a lot more about enchantment and what it means for the system not to be closed, for there to be like really, really good and really evil things happening all the time, visibly and invisibly, both. And so I think what I'm saying is that even in our like world of busyness and ease, reality crashes in still. Like even now in our post-enlightenment, utilitarian, like capitalistic culture, people still die and you still like live in reality with life and death and joy and sorrow and like struggle with meaningless and like deep encounter with meaning and profound encounters of beauty and then like long stretches of the ordinary. That's like what life is. And so there's something like irreducibly human about the lives we live that even in our culture, you just can't escape a spiritual dimension to the world. And that there's just this remainder, right? Like once everything is said and done and we have dinner on the table and we're saving in our 401k and we are doing all the stuff we do as Americans, like we go to bed at night, at the end of the day, we're still like people that wonder what our lives are for and what our lives are about. And especially in times of grief, it just crashes in. And so I think busyness is the way I avoid that. But even when I distract myself with other things, and I don't think it's all distraction. I mean, I wrote a whole book about how like the stuff that we spend our life on is
can matter.
Does matter.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I think it all just matters. Meaning is so powerful that it's just inescapable. And we can sort of run from questions of meaning, but they just crash in. They always crash in.
Is that experience of the quest for meaning in grief pushed you towards other people or away from other people?
It's been weird in my personal story because a move has been
new place.
Part of that.
Yeah.
So
it's hard to lead with, hi, I'm Tish, my dad just died.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So it's been a somewhat isolated time, which is part of the grief. But I have a new friend now. We became close at rapid rate because I started hemorrhaging and had to be rushed to the hospital when I was with her. You get close with people through crisis too. So, but I don't have a community yet. And I'm a priest. And so entering a community in need, but when you're the leader or a leader in that community has been a hard and interesting experience. So I don't know. It's been both. I mean, I think there's a few people in my life that are like, it's sink or swim with them, right? Like my husband. So it draws you closer to the people that you most need.
You've had this desire for beauty, and then you also said silence, and you made them sound kind of synonymous.
For me, they are not synonymous. They're certainly not. I mean, I experience beauty through my children. I mean, I honestly do experience quite a bit of beauty through them, and that's never silent. But I think silence has just been something I've craved in grief. I mean, it's funny because it's something I've craved, but it's something I've run from also. I mean, more than ever in my life since my dad died, it's so hard for me to like settle down and read or settle down and do something quiet. It's like I want to keep myself stimulated, but I need it. And the times that I have sat in grief have been incredibly healing, but they're healing because I'm letting myself feel all this bad stuff that I don't want to feel, which is why I run from silence, because it's sort of healing on the other side of it, but the actual work of it is like super painful. So
what I was thinking about when you said you crave beauty is the picture you texted me from a concert that
yes.
you went to where you were like, this is so amazing. And I thought,
oh my gosh, that's true.
Yeah.
And that was such a good example because I was so sad. And then I got free tickets to a Mumford & Sons concert and I was right at the front and it was beautiful. That was a gift right in the middle of that. But yeah, such an intense experience of beauty. And I feel like natural beauty has also been a huge part, I think, of my response to grief. And that often, for me, involves silence.
Right.
Although it doesn't always. Glory be to God, the Maker. Glory be to God, Creator.
My own experience with friends and in life and in community is that both grief and joy can either be isolating or catalytic in a community where they can be shared.
Yeah.
They're both phenomena that can be shared. And when they are shared, somehow they're deepened. One person's in grief and they welcome others into it. It validates the experience and makes it a little bit better. Same thing with joy. There's a certain type of shared experience that can either move you further into yourself or out of yourself. I've seen it go either way. Some people, when they're grieving, become lonely and isolated in a way that's not healthy, and other times to share it with a trusted few can actually sort of be a balm and can help. But it's not obvious which way it's going to go. And it also speaks to me to the need for rituals of re-enchanting the world.
Yeah.
So how do we collectively decide, pay attention to this because it's really important?
Yeah.
Or rituals around grief and mourning that are significant, not just for individuals, but for communities to endure together. Has that been your experience? I mean, what's the place of ritual in the sort of politics of a common life, meaning a shared existence?
Yeah. The thing about it can sort of move you in or isolate or move you out. I mean, I really think it's both. And I think that it's important that it is both in some sense. What I mean is that withdrawing can be a really bad and healthy thing, but I also think it can be a really good healing thing. Not being completely isolated, but times of stillness and silence and aloneness. I think particularly this is important for me as a writer and a pastor, because so much of my life is taken up with words and saying things to people and trying to say the right thing to people or have the right phrase. Words are, I mean, my favorite things. They're amazing. But I think they, just like anything, can be addictive, right? One of my very favorite stories from this Walter Rangarin book, I think it's the Book of Sorrows. There's this dog that gets a cut and it's bleeding to death and they heal it, but it never can fully heal because the animals talk in this book, because the dog keeps talking. And so he keeps ripping open this wound that, and all he needs to heal it is silence, but he won't. And in the end, the dog dies and his last words are, "I just wanted to talk." Mm-hmm. And I get that as someone who talks a lot and as a writer, that there is this addictive quality to words. So I think in grief, when you're in this place where like your experience is beyond what words can reach, there is this sort of silence before God that's, I think, important. Even aloneness can be really important in that. But that it has to be like tides going out and coming in. Like it would be unhealthy if we all lived our grief completely publicly, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, which can happen, and especially with social media now where everything's external. I think there's something disordered or that could hurt us about that. But then if we completely isolate and withdraw from community, I think that can be, and is, of course, really dangerous. So I think there has to be a rhythm, like the tides of inviting people into your grief, first the most trusted, and then more and more, to the extent you can. Not all griefs in life can be shared openly, but that you can invite people into that. And even the most private griefs share with your people, like your tightest people. But then I think there's, I mean, I guess I just think one is for the other. So times of silence and aloneness sort of prepare us and send us into community, and times of community nourish us and heal us and send us back into times of silence and aloneness. So,
and so
that's a ritual,
yeah,
right?
How
and
do rituals
so
work?
Bringing it back, yeah, to that. You know, what's interesting to me, I have had around that question, so many people tell me, I really fell in love with liturgy after I experienced this deep loss in my life. Like after my wife left me, or after I had a child die, or after I had a parent die. That, because that's the time where we know we want to come to God and we need healing, but we're too exhausted to drum up the right words or to get in a spiritual state that I think some parts of evangelicalism like call you to have to be in, like this cognitive or emotional place to meet God. And so liturgy becomes this like life raft that you can just throw yourself on, say the lines you're given, and they take you to shore. They bring you to God. And so I think rituals around liturgy have really helped, because even in a church service, there's times of silence. You kneel and are silent, and then there are words. And so that rhythm is good cross-training for the rest of our life. But then rituals in a day as well. I mean, all of us have times in our day, I hope, where we're alone or withdrawing or in prayer, and then we're sent out and we're with people a lot. At least I'm with people a lot in my day right now. And you see this in scripture too. Jesus has these times of engagement and times of withdrawal. And I think that can be communal. I mean, I feel like this is almost cliche to say now, but the church calendar, I feel like it's built in. Mm-hmm. Of there's Advent and Lent tend to be these contemplative, inward-focused times. And then there's the celebration. And then it culminates in Pentecost, which is very outward-focused, mission, going, doing, the kingdom coming through the church. But in a given year, sort of built into the system, are rhythms of more quiet contemplation and more joy and like celebration, but then also like activism. I mean, I think one of the ways to understand ordinary time is like our busy time, basically.
Yeah, I'm thinking about another part of that conversation with that writer about everyone having a hustle and his theological anthropology being that we all have a hustle, and the writer's hustle is paying attention. Another portion of that conversation was the two of us talking about how tired we are of the discussion of human beings in the church being always tied to the Imago Dei without any real specificity. So the sort of bland appeals to everyone's made in the image of God. What does that mean? We're not going to tell you.
Right.
We just know it's like really, really important. You know, we spent a lot of time talking about the phenomenon of naming in the moment in the Genesis narrative where God brings the animals before Adam and essentially says, what do you want to call them? And how that's this wonderfully humbling thing, because you don't get to create the elephant, but you get to decide,
yeah,
we're going to call it elephant. That as a way of thinking about what it means to be human, the capacity to name and the power of naming and the use of words in a way that matches the experience as best as we can, knowing that we do want to have an expansive understanding of meaning, that our words are never fully sufficient to describe the phenomenon in front of us. But this idea that what we do is we're creatures who name, and that's both an affront to our pride of thinking that we can create the world around us all the time, but it's also deeply ennobling, it seems to me, that that's what we get to do. We get to name. Liturgy and rituals do that for us. It's a kind of training in naming that allows us to lean on words when we don't have the capacity to name accurately.
Yeah. Yeah. With all this happening with grief in the last 6 months, there was this time where I was like, I'm going crazy. Like, I feel like I just cry all the time and randomly, and like, I'll be completely fine. Or someone will say something that sort of should make me sad and it doesn't. And then I'll be like making dinner and chopping a carrot and then find myself like overwhelmed with grief and just felt like, what is happening? I'm losing my mind. And then I went on this beach trip. This is what I meant by metaphor earlier. This is an example. I went on this beach trip and sand just got everywhere. And I just was noticing for like days and days after, everywhere I looked, there was like still sand, like in this book I was reading and in the bag that I brought to the beach. And like, it was in like my kids' socks. Like there was sand everywhere. And it was like sticky and gritty and textured and got everywhere. And then I was like, this grief is like sand. That metaphor set me free. And I felt like, oh, this makes sense. It's just that grief gets everywhere. So I could be chopping a carrot and it's there it is. It's right there. There's grief. And so it gave me sort of permission to let it be like random, because I would go, oh, grief is like sand. And then I ended up writing that in a piece. And people were like, thank you for that metaphor. That's such a great metaphor. Well, I didn't sit down and think, how can I come up with a good metaphor for grief? I was like grieving and this metaphor came to me and it set me free to grieve. So that's what I mean about like, I find these metaphors to make my life make sense to me. And then eventually some of them, like 10% of them, end up in a writing. The way this goes back to liturgy, I think, is that there's a tendency, certain folks have a tendency to think that if we put sort of words on the divine, that it flattens it. This can go for liturgy, and this can go for things like creeds and confessions, that we don't really want to say anything definitive about truth or God in worship or in writing or in creedal statements, because that limits God and it limits the mystery. And I've come to think that the way liturgy uses words is that it is very thoughtful over human communities over time about choosing the words that actually guard the mystery. That there's this mysterious reality of God and humanity that is beyond words. And we want to preserve that mysterious reality. And so we use our words. So wordlessness would not do that. I think we would lose the mystery because we wouldn't be able to say anything at all. Any kind of engagement with truth and with God or divinity or whatever you want to call it would be lost because there's nothing to say. And so we couldn't engage, right? Like I couldn't engage with you if there was nothing to say about you or nothing to, no word for me to understand you. But I think if it was wordless, we couldn't engage. I think also if we use words too lightly or if we choose the wrong words, we can flatten the mystery or try to tamp down the mystery. So I think liturgy is a way to use words to talk about God while preserving the mystery that those words point to, that they sort of symbolically gesture to, that they'll never fully sum up. I mean, that's why in scripture, right, it's like so profound that God gives his name, but he doesn't give his name. I mean, I am, yep. Right? There's this mystery beyond us, but it kind of like deigns to let us name it. There's something about liturgy that is sort of using words to worship together while preserving the mystery of what we're worshiping. I think there's also something about liturgy that teaches us the story, right? It teaches us the story of who we are. It teaches us the story of Christianity. And I see this, I mean, this is like straight out of Hauerwas, that we're like narrative form people. But since I've had kids, I'm like, whoa, we really, really are. Because my children, their names, what we named them is full of story. Like we chose those names for a reason. They're named after certain people we know, certain experiences we've had. And our kids ask us all the time, tell me the story of my name. My four-year-old constantly, tell me the story of when I was born. Like they just want to hear me tell them the stories of them. And I think it's because it is part of them. It's what makes them who they are, and it's how they understand who they are. So it comes back to this like beauty of like, these words are what teach us who we are. And so liturgy is part of that, is like ritual around the story. I mean, it's essentially like the church saying to the generation before it, like, tell us how you named us. Tell us who we are, exactly like my kids. You know, tell us how we were born. We're asking the generation before us to narrate our story to us over and over again.
And we take our place in that.
Yeah, we take our place and we learn the story and we keep telling the story.
Vocation in the Common Good is a production of New City Commons and the Narrativo Group. This episode was produced by Mike Cosper and Philip Lorish. It was edited by TJ Hester, and it was mixed by Mark Owens.